but not unkind or threatening in appearance. Wrinkles, which might have come from laughter, tugged at the edges of his eyes. Alenda thought his demeanour was remarkably cheerful, even friendly. She couldn't help thinking he was handsome, which was not the reaction she had expected to have about anyone she might meet in such a place. He was dressed in dirt-stained leather and wool, and was well-armed. On his left side he had a short sword with an unadorned hilt. On his right was a similarly plain, longer, wider sword. Finally, slung on his back, was a massive blade, nearly as tall as she was.
"My name is Hadrian, in case you've forgotten," he said, and followed the introduction with a suitable bow. "And who is this lovely lady with you?"
"This is Emily, my maid."
"A maid?" Hadrian feigned surprise. "For one so fair, I would have guessed her to be a duchess."
Emily inclined her head, and for the first time on this trip, Alenda saw her smile.
"I hope we didn't keep you waiting long. The Viscount tells me he and Mason were keeping you company."
"Yes, they were."
"Did Mr. Grumman tell you the tragic tale of his mother being run down by an insensitive royal carriage?"
"Why, yes, he did. And I must say—"
Hadrian held up his hands in mock defence.
"Mason's mother is alive and well. She lives on Artisan Row in a home considerably nicer than the hovel where Mason resides. She has never been a cook at the Rose and Thorn. He tells that story to every gentleman or lady he meets to put them on the defensive and make them feel guilty. You have my apologies."
"Well, thank you." He was rather rude, and I found his comments more than a little disturbing. "But now—"
Alenda paused.
"Did you— I mean, do you have—
were you able to get them?"
Hadrian smiled warmly, then turning, he called over his shoulder in the direction of the stable. "Royce!
If you knew how to tie a proper knot, I wouldn't be taking so long," said a voice from inside. A moment later, the other half of the pair emerged and joined them. Alenda's memory of him was easier to recall, because he was the more disturbing of the two. He was smaller than Hadrian, and possessed elegant features, dark hair and dark eyes. He was dressed in layers of black with a knee-length tunic and a long, flowing cloak that gathered about him like a shadow. Not a single weapon was visible. Despite his smaller size and apparent unarmed state, Alenda feared this man. His cold eyes, expressionless face, and curt manner had all the warmth of a predator. From his tunic, Royce drew forth a bundle of letters bound with a blue ribbon. Handing them to her, he said, "Getting to those letters before Ballantyne presented them to your father wasn't easy. As far as races go, it was very close, but ultimately successful. You might want to burn those before something like this happens again." She stared at the package as a smile of relief crossed her face.
I can't believe it. I don't know how you did it or how to thank you."
"Payment would be nice," Royce replied.
"Oh, yes, of course."
She handed the bundle to Emily, untied the purse from her waist, and handed it to the thief. He quickly scanned the contents, snapped the purse closed, and tossed it to Hadrian, who slipped it in his vest as he headed for the stables.
"You'd better be careful. It's a dangerous game you and Gaunt are playing," Royce told her.
"You read my letters?"
she asked fearfully.
"No, I'm afraid you didn't pay us that much."
"Then how did you know?"
"We overheard your father and Archibald Ballantyne talking. The Marquis appeared not to believe the Earl's accusations, but I'm certain he did. Letters or no letters, your father will be watching you closely now. Still, the Marquis is a good man. He'll do the right thing. My guess is he's so relieved Ballantyne doesn't have proof to take to court that your affair won't bother him much. However, as I said, you'd better be more careful in the future."
"How would the likes of you know anything about my father? Oh, I'm sorry. Did I say your father? I meant the other Marquis, the one with the appreciative daughter.
Elenda felt as though Royce had slapped her.
Making friends again, Royce?
Hadrian asked as he led two horses from the stable.
You'll have to forgive my friend. He was raised by wolves.
Those are my father's horses.
Hadrian nodded.
We left the carriage behind a bramble patch by the river bridge. By the way, I think I might have stretched out one of your father's doublets. I put it and the rest of his things back in the carriage.
You were wearing my father's clothes?
I told you, Royce repeated. It was close. Very close. They called it the Dark Room because of the business conducted in it, but the little back room at the Rose and Thorn was anything but gloomy. Several candles set in sconces on the wall and on the meeting table, along with a nice-sized fire burning in the hearth, gave off a warm, friendly light. A row of copper pots, reminders of the days when the dark room doubled as kitchen storage, hung from an exposed wooden beam. There was room for only one table and a handful of chairs, but it was more than enough for their purposes. The door opened, and a small party filed in. Royce poured himself a glass of wine, took a seat near the fire, removed his boots and wriggled his toes before the hearth. Hadrian, Viscount Albert Winslow, Mason Grumman, and a pretty young woman opted for chairs at the meeting table. Gwen, the owner of the tavern, always prepared a fine feast when they returned from a job, and that night was no exception. The evening selections included a pitcher of ale, a large roast, a loaf of freshly baked sweetbread, boiled potatoes, a cloth-wrapped cask of white cheese, carrots, onions, and the big pickles from the barrel normally kept behind the bar. For Royce and Hadrian she spared no expense, which included the black bottle of Montemorcy wine, which she had imported all the way from Vanden. Gwen always kept it on hand because it was Royce's favourite. Despite how appealing everything looked, Hadrian showed no interest in any of it. He focused his attention on the woman.
"So, how did it go last night?"
Emerald asked, sitting atop Hadrian's lap and pouring him a frothy stein of the inn's home brew. Her real name was Felina Brockton, but all the girls who worked at the tavern, or Medford House next door, went by monikers for their own safety. Emerald, a bright and cheery waif, was the senior barmaid at the Rose and Thorn, and one of only two women allowed in the dark room when a meeting was in session.
"It was cold," he told her, encircling her waist with his arms, "as was the ride here, so I desperately need warming."
He pulled her to him and began kissing her neck as a sea of brunette waves engulfed him.
"We did get paid, didn't we?"
Mason asked. The blacksmith had started to prepare a heaping plate almost the instant he sat down. Mason was the son of the former preeminent Medford metalworker. He had inherited his father's shop, but had lost it through a gambling habit, coupled with bad luck. Forced out of Artisan Row, he landed in the lower quarter, where he fashioned horseshoes and nails, making enough to pay for his forge, drinks, and the occasional meal. For Royce and Hadrian, he offered three benefits. He was cheap, he was local, and he was solitary. "We did indeed. Belinda Lanacklin paid us the full 15 gold tenants," Royce said.
"Quite the haul,"
Winslow declared, happily clapping his hands.
"And my arrows, how do they work?"
Mason asked.
"Do they anchor in the tiles?"
"They anchored just fine," Royce said. "Getting them out was the problem."
"The release failed?"
Mason asked, concerned.
"But I thought..." "Well, I'm no Fletcher." "You should have gone to a Fletcher. Told you that, didn't I? I'm a smith. I work with steel, not wood. That fine-toothed saw I made, that worked, didn't it? That's a smithing product, by Mar. But not the arrows, and for sure not ones like you wanted. No, sir. I done said you should have gotten a Fletcher, and you should have."
"Relax, Mason," Hadrian said, emerging from Emerald's mane.
"Of the two, The anchor was the most important, and it worked perfectly.
Course it did. The arrow tips are metal, and I no metal. Just disappointed the rope release didn't work. How did you get the rope down? You didn't leave it there, did you?
Couldn't. The guard would have spotted it on his next pass, Royce said.
So, how'd you do it?
Personally, I would like to know how you did the whole thing, Winslow said.
Like Royce, he was sitting back with his feet up and a mug in hand.
You never let me in on the details of these operations.
The Viscount Albert Winslow came from a long line of landless gentry. Years ago, one of his ancestors had lost the family fief. Now all that remained was his title. This was enough to open doors closed to the peasantry or merchant class, and was a step better than the common baronage. When Royce and Hadrian had first met him, he was living in a barn in Colnora. The pair invested a little money on clothes and a carriage, and he aptly performed the delicate duties of liaison to the nobles. With an allowance funded by them, the Viscount attended every ball, gala, and ceremony, patrolling the political landscape for business opportunities.
"You're too visible, Albert," Hadrian explained. "Can't afford to have our favourite noble hauled to some dungeon where they cut off your eyelids and pull off your fingernails until you tell them what we're up to.
But if they torture me and I don't know the plan, how will I save myself?"
"I'm sure they'll believe you after the fourth nail or so," Royce said, with a wicked grin.
Albert grimaced and took another long drink of his ale.
"But you can tell me now, can't you? How did you get past the iron door? When I met with Ballantyne, I had the impression a dwarf with a full set of tools couldn't get it open. It didn't even have a lock to pick or a latch to lift."
"Well, your information was very helpful," Royce said. "That's why we avoided it completely."
The Viscount looked confused. He started to speak, but instead remained silent and cut himself a piece of roast beef. Royce took a sip of his wine, and when he did, Hadrian took over the tale.
"We scaled the exterior of the East Tower, or rather Royce did, and he dropped me a rope. It wasn't as tall, but it was the closest to the one we were interested in. We used Mason's arrows to connect the two towers, and, with our knees wrapped around the rope, inched our way across the length, hand over hand."
"But there are no windows in the tower," Albert protested.
"Who said anything about using a window?" Royce interjected.
"The arrows anchored in the taller tower's roof."
"Yep, like I said, that was quality craftsmanship," Mason said proudly.
"So, that gets you to the tower. But how did you get in? Through the chimney?"
Albert inquired.
"No, it was too small. And last night there was a fire burning," Hadrian said. "So, we used Mason's second little tool, a small saw, and cut the roof on a bevel. All in all, the night was going pretty much according to plan, until Archibald decided to visit his study. We figured he'd have to leave eventually, so we waited."
"We should have just slipped down, cut his throat, and taken the letters," Royce insisted.
"But we weren't being paid for that, were we?" Hadrian reminded him.
Royce rolled his eyes in response. Ignoring him, Hadrian continued.
"As I was saying, we lay there waiting, and the wind on the top of that tower was bitter. Bastard must have sat in that room for 2 hours."
"You poor thing,"
Emerald purred, and nuzzled him like a cat.
"The good news was, he actually looked at the letters while we were watching him through the cuts, so he knew right where the safe was. Then a carriage came into the courtyard, and you'll never guess who it was."
"The Marquis arrived while you were on the roof?"
Albert asked, with his mouth full of roast beef.
"Yep, that's when our timetable got really tricky. Archibald left the tower to meet the Marquis, and we made our move."
"So," Emerald said, guessing, "you open the roof like the top of a pumpkin."
"Exactly. I lowered Royce into the study, he picked the safe, dumped the dummy letters, and I hauled him back up. Just as we replaced the roof section, Archibald and Victor walked in. We waited to make sure they didn't hear us. Incredibly, he presented the letters right there and then. I must say it was hilarious watching Archibald's reaction when he discovered the blank replacements. Things got pretty loud at this point, so we decided we'd better take the chance and rappel down the tower to the courtyard below.
That's amazing! I was telling Elenda sometimes problems occur during a job, but I had no idea I was telling the truth. We should have charged her extra,
Albert interjected.
It crossed my mind, Royce replied. But you know, Hadrian, still, we've made a nice profit on both sides of this one.
But wait, you didn't explain how you got the rope off the side of the tower if my releases didn't work.
Royce sighed.
Don't ask.
Why not?
The smith looked from one to the other.
Is it a secret?
They want to know, Royce, Hadrian said with a wide grin.
Royce frowned.
He shot it off.
He did what?
Albert asked, sitting up so abruptly his feet hit the floor with a clap.
Hadrian used another arrow to cut the rope at the roof line.
But that's impossible,
Albert declared. No man can shoot the width of a rope at, what was it, 200 feet maybe in total darkness?
There was a moon, Royce said, correcting him. Let's not make more out of this than it already is.
You forget, I have to work with him. Besides, it's not like he did it in a single shot.
How many arrows?
Emerald inquired.
What's that, sweetie?
Hadrian asked, wiping foam from his mouth with his sleeve.
How many arrows did it take for you to cut the rope, silly?
Be honest, Royce told him.
Hadrian scowled.
4.
4?
Albert said.
It was much more impressive when I imagined it was one lone shot, but still...
Do you think the Earl will ever figure it out?
Emerald asked.
The first time it rains, I imagine, Mason said.
There was a triple tap on the door, and the stocky smith pushed back his chair and crossed the room.
Who is it?
He asked.
Gwen.
Sliding the deadbolt free, he opened the door, and an exotic-looking woman with long, thick black hair and dazzling green eyes entered.
A fine thing when a woman can't get access to her own back room.
Sorry, gal,
Mason said, closing the door behind her.
But Royce would skin me alive if I ever opened the door without asking first.
Gwen Delancey was an enigma of the lower quarter. An immigrant to Avron from the distant nation of Calais, she survived in the city as a prostitute and fortune-teller. Her dark skin, almond-shaped eyes, and high cheekbones were uniquely foreign. Her talent for eye makeup and an Eastern accent made her an alluring mystery that the nobles found irresistible. Yet Gwen was no simple whore. In 3 short years she turned her fortunes around, buying up shop rights in the district. Only nobles could own land, but merchants traded the rights to operate a business. Before long she owned or possessed an interest in a sizable section of Artisan Row and most of the lower quarter. Medford House, commonly known as The House, was her most lucrative establishment. Despite its back-alley location, gentry from far and near frequented this expensive brothel. Gwen had a reputation for being discreet, especially with the identities of men who couldn't afford to be seen frequenting a brothel.
Royce, Gwen said, a potential customer visited the house earlier this evening. He was quite anxious to speak to one of you. I set up a meeting for tomorrow evening.
Know him?
I asked the girls. None of them have ever seen him before.
Was he serviced?
Gwen shook her head.
No, he was just after information about thieves for hire. Funny how a man always expects prostitutes to know everything when he is looking for answers, but assumes a girl will take his secrets to her grave.
Who talked to him?
Tulip.
She said he was foreign, dark-skinned, and she mentioned an accent. He might be from Calais, but I didn't bump into him, so I can't tell you for sure.
Was he alone?
Tulip didn't mention any companions.
Want me to talk to him?
Albert said.
Nah, I'll do it, Hadrian said. If he's poking around these parts, he'll probably be looking for someone more like me than you.
If you like, Albert, you can be here tomorrow and watch the door for strangers, Royce added. I'll keep an eye on the street.
Has there been anyone new hanging around?
It has been pretty busy, and there are a few people I don't recognize. There are four right now in the main bar, Gwen mentioned. And there was a different party of five a few hours ago.
She's right, Emerald confirmed. I waited on the five.
What were they like? Travellers?
Gwen shook her head.
Soldiers, I think. They weren't dressed like it, but I could tell.
Mercs? Hadrian asked.
I don't think so.
Mercenaries are usually troublesome. Grabbing the girls, shouting, picking fights. You know the type.
These guys were quiet, and one was a noble, I think. At least, some of the others referred to him as Baron something. Trumbull, I think it was.
I saw some like that up on Wayward Street yesterday, Mason said. Might have been as many as 12.
Anything going on in town? Royce asked. They looked at one another doubtfully.
Do you think it has anything to do with those rumours about killings out near the Nidwalden River? Hadrian asked. Maybe the king is calling up support from other nobles.
Are you talking about the elves? Mason asked. I heard about that.
Me too, Emerald said. They say elves attacked a village or something. I heard they slaughtered everyone, some even while they slept.
Who said that? That doesn't sound right, Albert commented. I've never known an elf to look a man in the eye, much less attack one.
Royce grabbed his boots and cloak and headed for the door. You've never known an elf, Albert, he said, as he abruptly left.
What did I say?
Albert asked, staring at everyone with an innocent expression. Emerald shrugged. Hadrian took out Elenda's purse and tossed it at the Viscount.
I wouldn't worry about it. Royce can be moody at times. Here, divvy out the profits.
Royce is right, though, Emerald said.
She appeared pleased that she knew something they did not.
The elves that attacked the village were wild elves, full-bloods. The half-breeds from around here are nothing but a bunch of lazy drunks.
A 1,000 years of slavery can do that to a person, Gwen pointed out.
Can I have my cut, Albert? I have to get back to work. We've got a bishop, the magistrate, and the Brotherhood of Barons visiting the house tonight.
Hadrian was still sore from the previous day's exertion when he took a seat at an empty table near the bar and observed the patrons of the Diamond Room. The name came from its odd, stretched rectangle shape, caused by how the addition fit into the space at the end of Wayward Street. Hadrian knew or was familiar with almost everyone in the room. Lamplighters, carriage drivers, tinkers, they were the usual late crowd who came in after work for a meal. They all had the same tired, worn-out, dirty look about them as they sat with their heads bowed over their plates. Each was dressed in a coarse work shirt and poor-fitting breeches gathered at the waist like the mouth of a sack. They chose this room because it was quieter, and they could eat in peace. One individual, however, stood out. He sat alone at the far end of the room, his back to the wall. His table remained bare except for the standard tavern candle. He hadn't bought a drink or a plate. He wore a wide-brimmed felt hat with one side pinned up by a lavish blue plume. His doublet, worn over a brilliant gold satin waist shirt, was made of rich black and red brocade with stuffed shoulders. At his side was a sabre attached to a fine studded leather girdle matching his high black riding boots. Whoever he wasn't hiding. Hadrian noted beneath the table a bundle on which he rested one boot at all times. Once Royce sent Emerald over with the news that the street was clear of associates, Hadrian got up and walked the length of the room, stopping before the empty chair in front of the stranger.
"Care for some company?" he asked.
"That depends," the man replied, and Hadrian noted the slightly saucy accent of a Calais native. "I am looking for a representative of an organization called Raira. Do you speak for that group?"
"That depends on what you want," Hadrian replied with a small grin.
"In that case, please sit down."
Hadrian took the seat and waited.
"My name is Baron Delano de Witt, and I'm looking to hire men of talent. I was told there were a few in the area that could be had for a price."
"What kind of talents are you looking to buy?"
"Procurement skills," DeWitt said simply. "I have an item I need to make disappear. If at all possible, I would prefer it to disappear completely. But it has to happen tonight."
Hadrian smiled.
"Sorry, I'm quite certain Raira won't work under such tight constraints. Too dangerous. I hope you understand."
"I'm sorry about the timing. I tried to reach your organization last night, but I was told you are unavailable. I'm in a position to make it worth the risk."
"Sorry, but they have very strict rules." Hadrian started to get up.
"Please, listen. I've asked around. Those who know the pulse of this city tell me there is a pair of independent professionals who take on such jobs if the price is right. How they manage to work with impunity outside of the organized guilds is a matter of speculation, but the fact remains that they do. This is a testament to their reputation, is it not? If you know these men, the members of this Raira, I beg you, implore them to assist me."
Hadrian considered the man. Initially, he had thought him to be another of the many self-absorbed nobles looking for a chuckle at some royal banquet. Now, however, the man's demeanour changed. There was a hint of desperation in his voice.
"What's so important about this item?"
Hadrian asked as he eased back into his seat.
"And why does it have to disappear tonight?"
"Have you heard of Count Pickering?
Master swordsman, winner of the Silver Shield and the Golden Laurel. He has an incredibly beautiful wife named Belinda, I think. I've heard he has killed at least 8 men in duels because of how they've looked at her, or so the legend goes."
"You are unusually well informed."
"Part of the job," Hadrian admitted. "In a contest of swords, the Count has only been beaten by Braga, the Archduke of Melangar, and that was in an exhibition tournament on the one day he didn't have his sword. He was forced to use a replacement."
"Oh, right,"
Hadrian said, as much to himself as to DeWitt.
"He's the one with the special rapier he won't duel without. At least not in a real fight."
"Yes, the Count is very superstitious about it."
DeWitt said nothing more for a moment and looked uncomfortable.
"Did you stare at the Count's wife too long?" Hadrian inquired.
The man nodded and bowed his head.
"I've been challenged to a duel tomorrow at noon."
"And you want Raira to steal the Count's sword?"
It was a statement, not a question, but DeWitt nodded again.
"I'm with the retinue of Duke de Lorcan of Dagestan. We arrived in Medford 2 days ago, part of a trade negotiation hosted by King Amrath. They held a feast for our arrival, and Pickering was there."
The Baron wiped his face nervously.
"I've never been to Avron before. For Maribor's sake, I didn't know who she was. I didn't even know she was his wife until I was slapped in the face with a glove."
Hadrian sighed.
"That is not an easy job, taking a prized sword from the bedside of..."
"Ah, but I've made it easier," DeWitt told him. "The Count, like me, is staying with the King for the negotiations. His quarters are very near my Duke's. Earlier this evening, I slipped into his room and took his sword.
There were so many people around, I panicked and dropped it in the first open door I found. It must be removed from the castle before he notices it's missing, since a search will surely find it. So, where is it now?
The Royal Chapel, he said. It's not guarded, and is just down the hall from an empty bedroom with a window. I can make certain the window will be open tonight. There are also ivy vines just outside the wall below the window. It should be a simple thing, really.
Then why don't you do it?
If thieves are caught with the sword, all that will happen is the loss of their hands. But if I am caught, my reputation will be destroyed.
I can see the reason for your concern, Hadrian said sardonically, but De Witt appeared oblivious.
Exactly. Now, seeing as how I have done most of the work, it doesn't sound so bad, does it? Before you answer, let me add this to the proposal.
With some strain, the Baron pulled the bundle from beneath his foot and placed it on the table. A metallic jingle rustled when the saddlebag settled on the wood.
Inside you'll find 100 gold tenets.
I see, Hadrian responded, staring at the bag and trying to breathe at an even pace.
And you are paying up front?
Of course. I'm not a fool. I know how these things work. I'll pay you half now, and half when I get the sword.
Hadrian took another controlled breath, nodding and reminding himself to stay calm.
So, you're offering 200 gold tenets?
Yes, De Witt said with a look of concern. As you can see, this is very important to me.
Apparently, if the job is as easy as you say.
Then, you think they will do it? He asked eagerly.
Hadrian sat back in his chair just as De Witt leaned forward anxiously. De Witt looked like a man set before a judge, awaiting sentencing on a murder charge. Royce would kill him if he agreed. One of the basic rules they had established for Rhaera was that they would not take jobs on short notice. They needed time to do background checks, verify stories, and case potential targets. Still, De Witt's only crime was choosing the wrong moment to look at a beautiful woman, and Hadrian knew he held the man's life in his hands. There was no chance he could hire anyone else. As De Witt had mentioned, no independent thieves other than them would dare take a job in a guild city. The officers of the Crimson Hand would not allow any of their boys to do it, for the same reason Hadrian felt he ought to turn it down. On the other hand, Hadrian was not really a thief and was not familiar with all their various deliberations. Royce was the one who had grown up on the streets of Ratibor, picking pockets to survive. He was the professional burglar, the ex-member of the infamous Black Diamond Guild. Hadrian was a warrior, a soldier who preferred his battles to be fair and in the daylight. Hadrian was never completely comfortable with most of the tasks they did for nobles. They wanted to embarrass a rival, to hurt an ex-lover, or to increase their standing in the strange and twisted world of high-stakes politics. The gentry hired them because they possessed fortunes and could afford to pay for their games. To them, that was what life was, one big chess match with real knights, kings, and pawns. There was no good or evil, no right or wrong, it was all just politics. A game within a game, with its own set of rules and no values. Their squabbles, however, did provide a fertile field for them to harvest profits. Not only were the nobles rich and petty, they were also dim-witted. How else could Royce and Hadrian receive payment from the Earl of Chadwick to intercept letters Alanda Lanacklin sent to Degan Gaunt, only to turn around and double their profit by stealing them back? They had simply asked Albert to contact Alenda with the news Ballantyne had her letters, and an offer to help get them back. Their business was profitable but ugly. Just another game he played in a world where heroes were legends and honour was a myth. He tried to rationalise that what he and Royce did was not that horrible. After all, a lender could certainly afford it. People like Mason and Emerald needed the money more than a wealthy Marquis's daughter. Besides, perhaps it taught her a valuable lesson that might save her father's reputation and lands. Yet it was still just a way of lying to himself, trying to convince his conscience that what he was doing was right, or at least, not wrong. He desired to do a job with merit, one with which he could actually save a man's life, one with intentions that resembled what he remembered as virtuous. "Sure," he said. When Hadrian finished speaking, the silence in the dark room was thick with anticipation. Only three men were present, and when Hadrian stopped, both he and Albert turned their attention to Royce. As expected, the thief did not look pleased, and began slowly shaking his head even before he spoke. "I can't believe you took this job," he scolded. "Look, I know it's short notice, but his story checks out, right?" Hadrian asked. "You followed him back to the castle. He's a guest of King Amrath. He didn't make any side trips. I can verify he appears to be from Calais, and none of Gwen's girls heard anything to contradict his claims. The job looks clean." 200 gold tenants to slip a sword out of an open window? You don't find that suspicious?" Royce asked with a tone of amazed disbelief. "Personally, I would call it a dream come true," Albert mentioned. "Maybe they do things differently in Calais. It's pretty far away," Hadrian argued. "It's not that far," Royce shot back. "And how is it this De Witt is walking around with that much coin? Does he always travel to international trade meetings carrying bags bursting with gold? Why did he bring it? Maybe he didn't. Maybe he sold a valuable ring tonight, or perhaps he obtained a loan using the good name of the Duke de Lorcan. It's even possible that he got it from the Duke himself. I'm certain the two of them didn't ride up here on a couple of ponies. The Duke likely travels in a huge caravan of wagons. To them, several hundred gold coins might not be unusual." Hadrian's voice became more serious. "You weren't there. You didn't see this guy. He's facing a virtual execution tomorrow. How much is gold worth if you're dead?" "We just got done with a job. I was hoping to take a few days off, and now you've signed us up for a new one." Royce sighed. "You say De Witt was scared?" "He was sweating." "So, that's what this is really about. You want to take the job because it's for a good cause. You think risking our necks is worth it, so long as we can pat ourselves on the back afterward." "Pickering will kill him. You know it. And he's not the first. He won't be the last either." Hadrian sighed and, folding his arms across his chest, sat back in his chair. "You're right. There'll be others. So, imagine we pinch the sword and get rid of the damn thing. The Count never sees it again. Think of all the happy men who could finally look at Belinda without fear." Royce chuckled. "So, now it's a public service." "And there is the 200 gold tenants," Hadrian added. "That's more money than we've made all year. Cold weather is coming, and with that coin, we could sit out the winter."
"Well, at least now you're talking some sense."
"That would be nice," Royce admitted.
"And it's only a couple of hours' work. Just a quick climb and grab. You're the one always telling me how poorly guarded Essendon Castle is. We'll be done and in bed before dawn."
Royce bit his lower lip and grimaced, refusing to look at his partner. Hadrian saw his opening and pressed his advantage.
"You remember how cold it was on top of that tower? Just think how cold it'll be in a few months. You can spend winter safe and warm, eating richly and drinking your favourite wine."
"Then, of course," Hadrian leaned closer, "there's the snow."
"You know how you hate the snow."
All right, all right. Grab the gear. I'll meet you in the alley.
Hadrian smiled.
I knew there was a heart in there somewhere.
Outside, the night was even colder than it had been. A slick frost formed on the roads. Winter snows would indeed be falling soon. Despite what Hadrian thought, Royce did not actually hate snow. He liked the way it blanketed the lower quarter, dressing it up in an elegant white gown. Nevertheless, its beauty came with a cost. Tracks remained in snow and made his job much harder. Hadrian was right. After that night, they would have enough cash set aside to spend the whole winter in quiet hibernation. With that much money, they could even consider opening a legitimate business. He thought about it every time they scored big, and he and Hadrian had discussed it on more than one occasion. A year ago, they had talked seriously about opening a winery, but it didn't suit them. That was always the problem. Neither could think of any lawful business that was right for them. He stopped in front of Medford House, at the end of Wayward Street, and across the street from the Rose and Thorn Tavern. The house was nearly as large as the tavern, which Gwen considered linking with it, by building extensions so customers could move back and forth freely without exposing themselves to the elements or public scrutiny. Gwen Delancey was a genius. Royce had never known anyone like her. She was clever and intelligent beyond reason, and she was more open and sincere than anyone he had ever met. She was a paradox to him, an impossible mystery he could not solve. She was an honest person.
"I thought you might stop by," Gwen said, stepping out onto the porch of the house and wrapping a cape about her shoulders. "I was watching for you through the doorway."
"You have good eyes. Most people never see me when I walk a dark street."
"You must have wanted to be seen, then. You are coming to visit me, weren't you?"
"I just wanted to be sure you received your portion of the payment last night."
Gwen smiled. As she did, Royce couldn't help noticing how beautifully her hair shimmered in the moonlight.
"Royce, you know you don't have to pay me. I'd give you anything you asked for."
"No," Royce insisted. "We use your place as a base. It's dangerous, and for that you get part of the profit. We've been over this."
She stepped closer and took his hand. Her touch was soothingly warm amidst the chilling air.
"I also wouldn't own the Rose and Thorn if it wasn't for you. There's a very good chance I wouldn't even be alive."
"I have no idea what you speak of, Your Ladyship," Royce said as he performed a formal bow. "I can prove I wasn't even in town that night."
She stared at him with the same smile. He loved to see her happy, but now her brilliant green eyes searched for something, and Royce turned away, letting go of her hand.
"Listen, Hadrian and I are taking that job. We have to do it tonight, so I need to..."
"You're a strange man, Royce Melbourne. I wonder if I'll ever really know you."
Royce paused and then softly said,
"You already know me better than any woman should, more than is safe for either of us."
Gwen stepped toward him again, her heeled shoes crunching on the frosty ground, her eyes intense with pleading.
"Be careful, won't you?"
"I always am."
With his cloak billowing in the wind, he walked away. She watched him until he entered a shadow and was gone.
Chapter 3. Conspiracies.
The crowned falcon standard flew from the highest tower of Essendon Castle, marking the presence of the king. The castle was the royal seat of the kingdom of Melengar, and although not especially large or powerful, it was nevertheless an old and respected realm. The castle, an imposing structure of elaborate grey walls and towers, stood at the centre of the capital city of Medford, forming the hub of the four distinct quarters of Gentry Square, Artisan Row, the Common Quarter, and the Lower Quarter. Like most cities in Avron, Medford sat behind the protection of a strong outer wall. Nevertheless, the castle also had its own fortifications, partitioning it from the general city. This inner wall, crowned with crenellated parapets where skilled archers kept watch from behind stone merlons, didn't completely encircle the castle. Instead, it connected to a large, imposing keep that served as its rear barrier. The height of the keep and the wide moat surrounding its base kept the king's home well protected. During the day, merchants wheeled carts to the castle wall and positioned themselves on either side of the gate, forming a tent city of bustling vendors, entertainers, and lenders who sought to do business with the castle inhabitants. This wave of local commerce receded at sunset, as citizens couldn't pass within 50 feet of the walls from dusk until dawn. This restriction was enforced by royal archers, who were trained to fire at those who ventured too close at night. Pairs of guards dressed in chainmail with steel helms bearing the falcon standard of Melengar patrolled the perimeter of the castle. They walked casually, with thumbs in their sword belts, often discussing events of the day or their off-duty plans. Royce and Hadrian watched the pace of the guards' routine for an hour before moving toward the rear of the keep. Just as De Witt had explained, negligent gardeners had ignored a spiderwork of thick-stemmed vines tracing their way up the stone. Unfortunately, the vines didn't reach as high as the windows. On this frosty late-autumn night, the swim across the moat was bone-chillingly cold. The ivy, however, proved to be quite reliable, and the climb was as easy as ascending a ladder.
"I now know why De Witt didn't want to do this himself," Hadrian whispered to Royce as they hung from the ivy. "After being frozen in that water, I think if I fell right now, I would shatter on impact."
"Just imagine how many chamber pots are dumped into it each day,"
Royce mentioned, as he drove a small ringed spike into the seam between two stone blocks. Hadrian looked up at the many windows he presumed led to bedrooms, and cringed at the implications.
"I could have lived without that bit of insight."
He pulled a strap harness from a satchel and fastened it to the eyelet of the spike's ring.
"Just trying to take your mind off the cold," Royce said, tapping in another spike.
Although tedious and tense, the process was surprisingly fast, and they reached the lowest window before the guards completed their circuit. Royce tested the shutter, which was open, as promised. He pulled it gently back, just a hair, and peered inside. A moment later, he climbed in and waved Hadrian up. A small bed draped in a burgundy canopy took up the center of one wall. A dresser with a wash basin stood beside it. The only other piece of furniture was a simple wooden chair. A modest tapestry of hounds hunting deer covered much of the opposite wall. Everything was neat, but sterile. There were no boots near the door, and no cloak thrown across the chair, and the bed covers showed no wrinkles. The room was unused. Hadrian remained silent near the window as Royce moved across the room to the door. He watched as the thief's feet tested the surface of the floor before committing his weight. Royce mentioned once how he had been in an attic on a job when he hit a weak board and fell through the bedroom ceiling. This floor was stone, but even stones sometimes had loose mortar or contained hidden traps or alarms. Royce made it to the door, where he crouched and paused to listen. He motioned a sign for walking with his hand, and then began counting on his fingers for Hadrian to see. There was a pause, and then he repeated the signal. Hadrian crossed the room to join his friend, and the two sat waiting for several minutes in silence. Eventually, Royce lifted the latch with gloved hands, but did not open the door. Outside they could hear the heavy footfalls of hard boots on stone, first one set, and then a second. As the steps faded, Royce opened the door slightly and peered out. The hall was empty. Before them lay a narrow hallway, lit by widely spaced torches, whose flames cast flickering shadows which created an illusion of movement on the walls. They entered the hall, quietly closed the door behind them, and quickly moved approximately 50 feet to a set of double doors, adorned with gilded hinges and a metal lock. Royce tried the doors, and then shook his head. He knelt, and pulled a small kit of tools from his belt pouch, while Hadrian moved to the far side of the hall. From where Hadrian stood, he could see the length of the corridor in both directions, as well as a portion of the stairs that entered from the right. He stood ready for any trouble, which came sooner than he had expected. A noise echoed in the corridor, and Hadrian could hear the faint sound of hard heels on stone coming in their direction. Still on his knees, Royce worked the lock as the steps grew closer. Hadrian moved his hand to the hilt of his sword when at last the thief quickly opened the door. Trusting to luck that the room was empty, the two slipped inside. Royce softly closed the door behind them, and the footsteps passed without pause. They were in the royal chapel. Banks of candles burned on either side of the large room. Supporting a glorious, vaulted ceiling, marble columns rose near the chamber's centre. Four rows of wooden pews lined either side of the main aisle. Cinquefoil-shaped adornments and blind tracery mouldings, common to the Nephron Church, decorated the walls. Alabaster statues of Maribor and Novron stood behind the altar. Novron, depicted as a strong, handsome man in the prime of his youth, was kneeling, sword in hand. The god, Maribor, sculpted as a powerful, larger-than-life figure with a long beard and flowing robes, loomed over Novron, placing a crown upon the young man's head. The altar itself consisted of a wooden cabinet with three broad doors and a rose-coloured marble top. Upon it, two more candles burned, and a large gilded tome lay open. DeWitt had told Hadrian he had left the sword behind the altar, and they headed toward it. As they approached the first set of pews, both men froze in mid-step. Lying there, face down in a pool of freshly spilled blood, was the body of a man. The rounded handle of a dagger protruded from his back. While Royce made a quick survey for Pickering's sword, Hadrian checked the man for signs of life. The man was dead, and the sword was nowhere to be found. Royce tapped Hadrian on the shoulder and pointed at the gold crown that had rolled to the far side of the pillar. The full weight of the situation registered with both of them. It was time to leave. They headed for the door. Royce paused only momentarily to listen to ensure the hall was clear. They slipped out of the chapel, closed the door, and moved down the hall toward the bedroom.
Murderers!
The sound was so close and so terrifying that they both spun with weapons drawn. Hadrian had his bastard sword in one hand, his short sword in the other. Royce held a brilliant white-bladed dagger. Standing before the open chapel door was a bearded dwarf.
Murderers!
The dwarf cried again, but it was not necessary. Footfalls could already be heard, and an instant later soldiers with weapons drawn poured into the hallway from both sides.
Murderers!
The dwarf continued, pointing at them.
They've killed the king!
Royce lifted the latch to the bedroom door and pushed, but the door failed to give way. He pulled and then pushed again, but the door would not budge.
Drop your weapons, or we'll butcher you where you stand,
a soldier ordered. He was a tall man with a bushy mustache that bristled as he gritted his teeth.
How many do you think there are? Whispered Hadrian.
The walls echoed with the sounds of more soldiers about to arrive.
Too many, Royce replied. Be a lot less in a minute,
Hadrian assured him.
We won't make it. I can't get the door open. We have no exit. I think someone spiked it from the inside. We can't fight the entire castle guard, Put them down now!
The soldier in charge shouted, and took a step closer while raising the level of his sword.
Damn!
Hadrian let his blades drop. Royce followed suit.
Take them!
The soldier barked.
Ulrich Essendon awoke, startled by the commotion. He wasn't in his room. The bed he was lying in was a fraction of the size and lacked the familiar velvet canopy. The walls were bare stone, and only a small dresser and wash table decorated the space. He sat up, rubbing his eyes, and soon realized where he was. He had accidentally fallen asleep, apparently several hours ago. He looked over at Tilly, her bare back and shoulder exposed above the quilt. Ulrich wondered how she could sleep with all the shouting going on. He rolled out of bed and felt around for his nightshirt. Determining his clothes from hers was easy to do, even in the dark. Hers was linen. His was silk. Awakened by his movement, Tilly groggily asked, "What's wrong?" "Nothing. Go back to sleep," Ulrich replied. She could sleep through a hurricane, but his leaving always woke her. That he'd fallen asleep was not her fault, but he blamed her just the same. Ulrich hated waking up here. He hated Tilly even more, and was conscious of the paradox. Throughout the day, her need for him attracted Ulrich, but in the morning it repulsed him. Of all the castle servants, however, she was by far the prettiest. Ulrich didn't care for the noble ladies his father invited to court. They were haughty and considered their virginity more valuable than the crown. He found them dull and irritating. His father thought differently. Ulrich was only 19, but already his father was pressuring him to pick a bride. "You'll be king some day," Amrath told him. "Your first duty to the kingdom is to sire an heir." His father spoke of marriage as if it were a profession, and that was how Ulrich saw it as well. For him, this, or any other form of work, was best avoided, or at least postponed as long as possible.
"I wish you could spend the whole night with me, my lord,"
Tilly babbled at him as he pulled his nightshirt over his head.
"Then you should be grateful I dozed as long as I did."
With his toes, he felt along the floor for his slippers, and finding them, he slid his feet into the warm fleece lining.
"I am, my lord."
"Good night, Tilly," Ulrich said as he reached the door and stepped outside.
"Good..."
Ulrich closed the door before she finished. Tilly usually slept with the other maids in a dorm near the kitchens. Ulrich brought her to the little vacant bedroom on the third floor of the castle for privacy. He didn't like taking girls to his room. His father's bedroom was right next door. The vacant room was on the north side of the castle, and because it received less sunlight, it was always cooler than the royal chambers. He pulled his nightshirt tight and shuffled down the corridor toward the stairs.
"I've checked all the upper floors, Captain. He's not there,"
Ulrich heard someone say, from just up the steps. By the speaker's curt tone, Ulrich guessed him to be a sentry. He spoke to them rarely, but when he did, they were always abrupt, as if words were a commodity in short supply.
"Continue the search. Down to the prisons if necessary. I want every room examined. Each pantry, cabinet, and wardrobe. Do you understand?"
Ulrich knew that voice well. It was Wylan, the captain of the guard.
"Yes, sir, right away."
Ulrich heard the sentry trotting down the steps, and he saw the soldier stop abruptly the moment he met Ulrich's gaze.
"I found him, sir,"
the soldier shouted with a hint of relief.
"What's going on, captain?"
Ulrich called out, even as Wylan and three other castle guards rushed down the steps.
"Your Royal Highness."
The captain knelt briefly, bowing his head, then rose abruptly.
"Benton," he snapped at the soldier. "I want 5 more men here protecting the prince right now. Move."
"Yes, sir."
The soldier snapped a salute and ran back up the stairs.
"Protecting me?" Ulrich said. "What's going on?"